listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Hello out there, listeners. You're listening to Praxis. Before we get going with our interview today, I'll remind you that Praxis receives support from Puffin Glass Studios, a purveyor of functional glass art and smoking accessories, 8 locations in the state of Washington. Information available at 509-328-0661 and online at puffinglassstudios.com. And as I said, you're listening to KYRS and Praxis. I have an interview lined up today by phone, despite a little technical difficulty, with Jason Ortiz. He is an organizer with Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation and coming to Spokane to give a talk in the next couple days here. Hey, Jason, can you still hear me?
Yes, I'm still here.
On our setup there. Great. Would you care to just introduce yourself to our listening audience and let them know a little bit about your work?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you again so much for having me. I'm really excited to come to Spokane in a few days here. It'll be my first time going to Washington State, so I'm super excited to see it. I've heard some really great things. And I'm lucky enough to be doing it as the campaign strategist for Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. And so my job is to help local campaigns and coalitions connect with our membership, which is a pretty diverse community of folks that have had a loved one taken by violence. And we want to make sure that as they move forward, they have opportunities to advocate for what they believe in and lift their voices and tell their stories. And so my job is to help them connect with the advocates and activists that are doing the work on the ground.
That sounds like a lot, but also awesome. So in the title of the organization, Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, what does reconciliation mean? I know that on this tour you're being brought by the Peace and Justice Action League that does a lot of death penalty abolition work. Is all of the work death penalty abolition, or is that a component of what reconciliation means?
Okay, two questions there. I'll tackle the reconciliation one first because it is a bit of a tricky answer. And so, honestly, our membership has a pretty diverse opinion on how to move forward in regards to what happens after the crime has been committed. And so we don't really have one particular thing that we say is the right thing that we do or what we necessarily encourage folks to do. But reconciliation can mean a few different things. There are folks that would like to see if they can figure out the best way to move forward without necessarily having to forgive or forget the situation. And so for those folks, reconciliation really means you can't go back and change what happened, but you can control how you live moving forward. And so for them, it's reconciling within themselves what happened and choosing to live a life that can take that and make the best of it. And then there's other folks that do want to, you know, try to see if they can find a space within themselves to be able to forgive the situation and move forward in that way. And for them, reconciliation really means having an opportunity to really cope with the situation, be supported by our friends and family members in a way where they can express how they feel about it, and then try to find a way to forgive. And so we support both of those options for our members.
Awesome. And this specific event, which is going to be Thursday night, this coming Thursday night for people listening either live or to the podcast, February 5th at 6:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church out on Fort George Wright Drive, is with Pat McCoy is the speaker. And obviously, you know, Pat, could you give a little background on Pat's story and what people can expect to hear and learn about?
Absolutely. And so I've actually had the pleasure of working with Pat both through MVFR and through other organizations. Pat is an amazing activist here in North Carolina. He is the executive director of an organization called Action NC. And Action NC works on many different issues from immigration reform, finding affordable housing for communities, protecting public education, climate justice. And so he's a real pillar here in North Carolina, and I'm really excited to be able to share him a little bit with the folks of Washington. The Pat's connection to MVFR and to Washington, actually, is his sister was taken in Spokane a while back. And so he has a particularly intimate relationship with the state, and so he's actually really excited to go back and do some great work there. And so he's going to be able to speak a little bit about his story, about how he went through both dealing with the murder and then dealing with how to proceed afterwards, and how he still, throughout the process, remained of the mind that he opposed the death penalty. And so he's going to be able to tell the group that will be with us, you know, a little bit about what that felt like for him and what it feels like to be able to work now to use that story for good and try to do what he can to inspire other family members to speak up.
That's great. I think that a lot of people's knee-jerk, you know, support of the death penalty is based on an assumption that that's what they would want if they're, you know, if they or mm-hmm. their family, someone they care about, was a victim of some kind of violent crime. And
right.
what do you see, I mean, working with people who are in that situation, not hypothetically, but actually,
mm-hmm.
are there some commonalities to that? Are there some truths that people tend to walk away from that kind of experience with? Or is it scattered across the board?
You know, like I said, we have a very diverse organizational background of our membership, because unfortunately, violence strikes all communities, you know, across the board in every demographic on this planet. And so that's an unfortunate, you know, tie that binds us together, but it is something that provides us with a lot of different perspectives on the situation. And so MVFR is comprised in a large part with members that have had a loved one taken by murder, but there's also members that have had a loved one taken by capital punishment. And so, for instance, Kimberly Davis, Troy Davis's sister, is on our board. And so it's a very different experience there about how the death penalty itself affects families, right? And being able to share those stories with each other is really an, you know, inspiring experience, to say the least. And to hear folks be able to have those conversations openly in a loving manner, it really just goes to show that the individuals, when they're affected by these situations, don't have any inherent drive for violence. Right. And so that's where the death penalty puts families in a decision to have to choose that as, you know, sort of the only other option. And so we see the death penalty really divides families around whether or not they have to choose the death penalty or something else. And
yeah.
So it also just really it distracts the criminal justice system from really finding out what how we can prevent violence, and instead we're spending millions of dollars on the death penalty.
Yeah, this is definitely an issue that the more I've learned about it and people I've met, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's really wasteful of money if you want to come at it from that aspect. That's not my personal favorite angle to come at it from, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's millions
right,
of dollars.
Sure.
It's more expensive than life in prison.
Yeah, and there was just, you know, a recent university, I think it was Yale University study that showed that it was $1 million more per case. And so roughly, you know, a non-capital punishment murder case would cost roughly $2 million, and that one that was capital punishment would cost $3 million. And so if you think about who's actually, you know, most affected by the crimes, it's the victim's families. And I'm sure that, you know, the victim's families could have used some extra support when it came to doing funeral costs or even just the direct cost of participating in the process. If you think about the cost that's financial, but what about the cost to the family member that has to go to court and redo this over and over and over again?
Mm-hmm. And we've also seen, I mean, another aspect of it that that I find interesting that I wonder about your perspective on is just the disturbingly high number of exonerations from death row that we've seen. Pajal's just produced The Exonerated, the play that's a dramatization of certain people's stories who were wrongly put on death row. I mean, it's into the at least couple hundreds, I believe.
I believe the number's actually right about 150.
150, yeah. So
100 so far have been exonerated.
Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, as with most of the criminal justice system, disproportionately non-white, non-wealthy men and women. And
right.
That is is a bit disturbing. So where does that overlap into the work that you are all doing? I mean, that's a weird way to phrase that question. Sorry. I'm also reading.
For sure. No, I mean, I'll tackle sort of the racial aspect of it real quick. So actually here in North Carolina, MVFR did support the Racial Justice Act that was going to be able to allow folks that have had, you know, not exactly the most clear-cut investigations into their cases, we looked at to see if there was any racial bias in any part of the process. And so MVFR definitely supported that, as we want to make sure that no matter what the state chooses to do as far as punishment, that, you know, the process is as fair and just as humanly possible. Of course, we don't think that the death penalty is ever going to be actually be able to use successfully, because there's always going to be innocent folks put to death. So we are seeing that, you know, 150 people have been exonerated, and it's, you know, it's been increasing lately when it comes to the various technologies that we can use. And what is sort of lost in the shuffle sometimes is how that re-victimizes the families. Because at one point in time, we thought that they might have had closure, or they might have been told that they would get closure from it, and now 20, 30 years later, the whole wound is going to be reopened again. And so we've seen with capital punishment, folks tend to rush to try to find a verdict, right? Because they want to find whatever it is that they're looking for, whether it's peace, whether it's a conviction. And later on, we see that they were coerced or forced into that. They're forced into their confession. And so we've seen this happen over and over again. Folks that probably weren't in an intellectual space to be able to really understand what they were doing confess to a crime. We think it's done. And then 30 years later now, the families have to go through that all over again without knowing exactly what happened now.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I think the more, this is one of those issues that the more you learn about it, the more you see all of the intersections through the whole system, through the whole justice system, and the whole society, really, you know, why is all this violence happening in the first place? And I can see that it looks like you have some resources posted on the MVFR site about restorative justice. I don't know if we want to dive all the way into that since we're the events on the death penalty, but it's a topic I've revisited a lot on this show. And it's been a while, though. So I'm wondering if you could explain that for listeners and talk a little bit about how those kind of transitions can be made and how local communities might be organizing around trying to shift these big, unwieldy justice systems to something more just.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So as far as restorative justice goes, our membership is super diverse. And so for MVFR, we're a community where we try to provide as many resources for family members as possible. And so for those folks that are looking for things like restorative justice, where they want to engage in a process that they can deliberately think about the situation and work towards a better, fuller understanding of how they would like to move forward, we absolutely support that and have resources for folks. We have a lot of experts, you know, that have worked on this particular thing, restorative justice in North Carolina. We have some great folks. John Powell is a great guy. And so, you know, whenever our members find or would like a way to heal, we try to provide someone that can provide them with that service. And so what that looks like will be entirely up to the particular member. And so what was your other question?
Oh, I was wondering in terms of community-wide, how folks might be able to, it's an unwieldy question and there might not be an answer, which is fine. I'm all about that here, but how communities might be able to start to incorporate some more restorative practices into their justice system rather than this kind of retaliation model that we have.
Right. Well, I mean, so unfortunately, when we talk about communities and the justice system, our communities don't really have a whole lot of say in our justice system, and that's really unfortunate. And so it's a little bit difficult to see the restorative justice kind of happen within the criminal justice system. I think what communities can do instead is find other folks that are dealing with the similar situation as they are and find a place where they can talk about it and express what it is that they're dealing with. And, you know, luckily we have folks on across the spectrum of recovery so that, you know, we have some folks that have experienced loss very recently and also folks that have experienced loss a long time ago that have come to a place where they can support others. And so I think that's the best thing about our organization is just the different members we have. And so if somebody was interested in joining or bringing folks together in their neighborhood, I think the best thing to do would be to contact us. You can get me at jortiz@mvfr.org. Marcel Close is our membership engagement coordinator. And she's really great at finding wherever you are, who's the closest member that's near you that, you know, might be able to reach out to you. And if anything, MVFR members are of the most supportive and loving kind I've ever met. And so the best thing I think would be to just find folks that are near you and see what you can do together.
Yeah, that sounds promising. I mean, as promising as anything can sound within this thing that we've built. And I just want to remind people who are just joining us that we're talking to Jason Ortiz of Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. MVFR.org is the site that he was referencing for the email. And they'll be bringing Pat McCoy to speak about this topic and about his own personal experience with his sister murdered in Spokane in 1974 and his journey through dealing with that process and how it did not affect his feeling at the end of the day about the death penalty. So interesting stuff hosted by Peace and Justice Action League and Murder Victims Family for Families for Reconciliation at the Unitarian Universalist Church Thursday night, February 5th at 6:30 p.m. That's a mouthful, but how did you get involved in this work, Jason? I guess we should back up. Kind of went right for the broad stuff at the beginning.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I can give a little more background about myself. So, you know, a while back I graduated from the University of Connecticut. I'm originally from Connecticut with a bachelor's in public and community engagement. And so it was a great program. And so it set me up great to be an organizer for various nonprofits. And I spent a little bit of time as a digital strategist for a web firm. And MVFR was one of my clients, and I was working for that firm. And so I got to work directly with Scott and Marcel and the great team at MVFR and helped them build their website a little bit, and eventually decided, you know, I think I just want to work for MVFR directly, and so moved on to that. And, you know, I am not personally a member, so I don't have the same, you know, sort of experience as a lot of our members do. But I have been against the death penalty for a really long time. When I was at school, I did help with the campaign in Connecticut to abolish, and they successfully abolished, and I'm really proud of that. That was definitely a good thing to see coming. It was difficult, but, you know, it happened. And so we became, you know, one of the many states so far where getting upwards of 50% of states that no longer use or have outright abolished the death penalty. And so it's really a time right now, I think, where folks getting involved could really push us towards being able to repeal the death penalty permanently on a federal level, you know, before 2020. And I think that's a real reality. And so one of the things that as an organizer, I always try to do is help campaigns that are ready to win. And I think we are, and I'm super excited to be a part of the movement that will, you know, in the near future, abolish the death penalty.
Yeah, I'm looking at a graph of it, and it looks like a pretty steady increase through the 70s to a peak right around mm-hmm. the turn of the 21st century, and a steady decline since then. And you see, you know, kind of state by state, all of this shifting. Is Washington pretty likely, in your opinion, to be one of those next states?
I think it absolutely has potential for it. I mean, your governor is pretty supportive. He issued will be issuing a moratorium here soon. And there's a bill to repeal in the legislature being introduced. So of all the states in the union that we have left, Washington is definitely, you know, one of our top priorities with MVFR, because we think you guys can really pull it off here soon. And so that's, you know, one of the major reasons I'm coming up in the week. I'm going to be able to check out Seattle and meet with the coalition folks there. But I'm really excited, and the energy that is, you know, on the team on the ground there, y'all are in a really special place.
Yeah, and I wonder, is there a lot, I mean, you've seen this in Connecticut, probably fairly different than Eastern Washington, at least politically, but, and in other states, where do you think that the opposition to ending the death penalty, the ongoing support for it, where do you think that comes from, either culturally or politically or whatever angle you want to take?
Yeah, that is a great question. And so I think, you know, just like folks that oppose the death penalty are really diverse, I think the opposition is pretty diverse too. There are plenty of folks that, you know, believe that by removing folks from society that we will be reducing crime, you know, and I think there's some of those that are very tough on crime, and that they believe, you know, in their heart of hearts that, you know, this is what we should do to keep an orderly society. I personally disagree with them on that that's what we need to do. But, you know, I've definitely met folks that feel that strongly. And then I think there's, you know, the institutional problem here is that the death penalty exists now, and the onus has to be to remove it. And that means that we have to push it as an issue to actually be heard and get on the top of the agenda. And so a lot of it for me isn't so much that folks that oppose the repeal necessarily strongly support the death penalty as much as they don't want to deal with the question about the death penalty. And I think part of that is because in the abstract, the death penalty feels wrong, right? We don't want to be having the state actually have the power to kill people. But then when individual cases arise, that's when it becomes a little bit more difficult for folks to justify making it a political priority, right? And so, for instance, you've had situations where, you know, there's been very public killings, right? But there's going to be a national outcry and request for the death penalty because there was a really particularly tragic crime. And in those situations, politicians that are both for repeal and also maybe aren't super strong for the death penalty, but, you know, wouldn't normally get in their way, you'll see it become a political issue, and that's unfortunate. But it's one of those things that, honestly, if it is a quiet issue, it's more likely to pass than if folks make a big deal out of it, because those particular cases can be so visceral for folks.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a big part of it. And it also, I mean, my angle on it will be about, you know, state control and privatization mm-hmm. of certain, you know, military and otherwise services that happen in this mm-hmm. country. And I think hearing about cases like that does a lot to keep people afraid, for one, of mm-hmm. of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of just drives the spiral of violence, and we don't know when it ends. So as far as that goes, how does the U.S., I'm assuming that MVFR is a U.S.-based organization entirely?
Yeah.
Or okay.
Yep.
And what
For
are
now.
Those numbers like as far as violent crime, specifically murder? How does that stack up in the U.S. compared to around the world?
Well, as far as, in comparison to around the world, that's going to be a tricky one to answer. I mean, we do have much more prevalent of violent crime in the U.S., particularly gun crime, is much higher than a lot of the rest of the world. But when it comes to how much crime happens, I guess, I think within the U.S., it is much more a cultural attitude towards crime and how we deal with it than how much crime actually happens that I think is the big problem. You know, there's definitely always going to be violence, you know, in society for the near future anyway, before we can really figure some, you know, serious things out. And so I think in the U.S. here, we just take a very punitive approach that we want to punish people in order to make an example out of them so that it'll affect everyone else. And it's a very fear-based solution to the problem of violence. And we're seeing how that is used throughout the country, not just when it comes to the death penalty, but a lot of different issues out there, that the more folks are afraid of their fellow person and the more folks are afraid of just society in general, the more likely they are to close off and not want to participate in society. And that is really destructive for us as a whole community, to be so afraid of each other. And unfortunately, the tough on crime folks really play off of that fear and that anxiousness in order to make political points, and that's just really unfortunate. And I think the folks that are most affected in the process are those that are the families, the victims of crime, that are basically being ignored but also spoken for. And then it just seems a really inappropriate response to violence.
Yeah, it does. It seems like, you know, adding insult to injury to kind of use people for political gain, and then, you know, I don't know, while you're
right.
perpetuating the system that hurt them in the first place. But
right, and I think if you look at budgets, you know, and budgets show you what you value, the amount of money that is spent punishing folks and prosecuting capital cases specifically, but just punishment in general, versus helping the families that need help and restitution to be able to move on from the crime, is a dramatic difference, right? And it's really a sad difference that mm-hmm. we have there. But, I mean, it shows us kind of where our priorities are right now in punishing folks rather than helping those that are most effective. And I think that's a switch that our country really needs to make.
Yeah. How did, and if this is out of your realm of knowledge, feel free to tell me without shame, but how did we come to have a system like that in the first place? Obviously, the death penalty didn't originate in the United States, and it's been with us for quite a long time around the world, but where, I don't know, what is the origin of it? And Who else is still doing it?
That is a bit out of my knowledge.
Yeah,
I'll be honest.
Sorry,
that's a history lesson out of mine, too.
I know. How about instead of that?
Right. I mean, I think, company? To be honest, you know, this is a guess as, you know, I was not a history major by any stretch of the imagination, but we've had, you know, capital punishment in various forms for a very long time. Right. I mean, since we've had monarchies and, you know, all that, where we had folks that could be headed at the whim of a king, that we haven't shifted that much astray from that here. You know, we just have a much more bureaucratic system that has it done. And so it's something that over time, various communities have decided that it is not something they want to continue. But I feel like it's definitely been more countries out there have had the death penalty in their history for a very long time. It's, you know, as far as civilization is concerned, you know, pretty recent that we've decided that killing each other by the state is wrong. Mm-hmm. At least a lot of countries have. And so it's something that I think has been ingrained with us for a very long time. We've settled things through violence for thousands of years as our civilizations. And, you know, now, thankfully, we're actually getting less violent as a world. And that is a beautiful thing. It's just, you know, some of us would hope it was happening a little faster than it is, but we are making progress, I think, on a societal front, you know, as far as the global community goes. And here in the U.S., you know, we are definitely a political leader for the rest of the world, and we are also moving towards abolishing the death penalty. And mm-hmm. so I think, you know, the time of the death penalty as something that is normal or accepted is definitely coming to an end. And then, you know, shortly thereafter that, we'll see it repealed across the globe, I think.
Definitely. I mean, we're one of the lingering few across mm-hmm. the globe who use it, and especially who use it at the scale per capita mm-hmm. that we do. And
for sure.
Yeah, but it's like you said, I think that that brings me to something I was going to ask you earlier. Sorry, this is a very scattered interview on my part, but you're full of interesting answers, so it makes it easy. But this word, I kind of want to return to this idea of reconciliation, because mm-hmm. as you said, I really like to hear hopeful things. Thanks for plugging that, because I really think that you're right, that humanity is going in a less violent direction. We're able to all see each other much more efficiently than we ever could before, and kind of get the idea that humanity's pretty much the same across differences of varying kinds. I think, you know, science is converging with a lot of spiritual ideas about, you know, maybe we're all the same stuff and we should act like it. how does that work of reconciliation, you know, it's in the name of the organization, how does that play out? And does it mostly play out for individuals connecting with each other? What's the process like generally? And how can we maybe learn from it, even if we're just trying to reconcile, you know, daily violence rather than these really personal cases?
Right. And so, I mean, this is another example to sort of show the spectrum of recovery that our membership is in. And so what reconciliation could mean for each one is totally different. But I think, you know, folks that have had their loved one take it from them very recently, the first thing that they would like to do is usually have someone listen to them, right, and really hear what's going on within them and what they might need help with. And so for those folks, you know, we have them talk to Marcelle, who's our membership coordinator. Or anyone at MVFR would be more than happy to do it, but she's particularly trained for that. And for them, you know, we ask them, what do they think they need from us in order to find peace in this particular moment, right? And so it could be that they just want to talk to another member and figure out a way that they can reconcile the situation for them, even if it's in a temporary sense. It also might come from, as our membership grows in different places, we hold meetings and we have hold events. And so sometimes reconciliation for them is just knowing that there's a community out there for them that can support them and has been through the same thing that they have. Right? And for some folks, that's the most important thing, is they want to know that they have a community of folks that they can go to and turn to and share some work and some sympathy, and maybe even, you know, get together and do something to advocate for an issue that they care about. And so that's sort of, folks that might be in the middle level of recovery. And then you have folks that have been with us for a very long time, and the way that they would like to find justice and reconciliation within themselves is to advocate for the end of the death penalty. And they use their story to talk to politicians or to other prospective members of society that they might want to convince and share their story, because so often those folks hear when capital cases come up that victims' family members want X, Y, or Z, right? And there's always broad generalizations about this is for the family or which family are we talking about. And so for those folks, finding reconciliation is really finding how they can take this tragic thing that happened to them and use it for good and find power and find happiness in that activism. And so for them, you know, they will work with other family members at the highest levels of politics and government to help get repeal. And that's just an example. I would say that it could be many different things for many different people, and we just like putting people together to get the support they need.
Awesome. Seems like a logical, effective, and comforting first step for a lot of things. So, mm-hmm. And so that's what Pat McCoy will be doing on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Right.
And yep. That, once again, for people who may be just joining us here on Praxis, I'm talking with Jason Ortiz about this talk that Pat McCoy will be giving, both from Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, MVFR. That will begin at 7 p.m. Doors are at 6:30 p.m. At the Unitarian Universalist Church. I have a link to the event on the Praxis Facebook page at facebook.com/praxisradio. You can also find it at peacejustice.org. And yeah, those are the best places to find that. But Thursday, February 5th at 6:30 p.m. at the UU Church. So yeah. And I really like alliteration. And so I was finding this this page about the death penalty on the MVFR site that I'll just share with people. This is under, it talks about how it causes harm, it being the death penalty. And you've got five D's. It's because it distracts, yep. distracts the public and the judicial system from the more important issue of what victims' families and their communities need to heal and become safer, diverts resources, divides, delays, and damages. Is that a framework that you all came up with there?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's those our five B's there that we use. It was kind of a funny conversation with our executive director, Scott Bass, about listicles. And so we wanted to come up with a listicle, and I was going to share online, that really encapsulates the different reasons why we oppose the death penalty. And we think they're pretty straightforward and specific, you know, and that, you know, when folks read them, they'll understand where we're coming from. And so they're not super complicated or super political. It's just truths about, you know, the flaws within the death penalty system that we have right now and the ways that it harms both family members and the public and, you know, the society at large. And I think, you know, things like the amount of effort that goes into putting forward this case definitely is going to, you know, distract folks from helping the family members. There's a lot of media attention that will ask them how they feel about it, but there won't actually be a whole lot of attention to help them, you know, be supported. And I think that's a huge distraction when these tragedies happen, when we really should be doing supporting each other. But unfortunately, the capital punishment system, when someone chooses to go for it, the family members often get left behind, and it's unfortunate. And so, you know, on top of that, it's just, you know, the strict resources that we're talking about of diverting millions of dollars of public funds, that it's just an unnecessary place. And so, as we all know, budgets are really tight. Public school systems could definitely use extra money. Our victims' family members, you know, all have kids in schools, and they're, you know, regular members of society. And to see money go to waste in this way is really disheartening, and it's unfortunate. And it's just one of the ways that the capital punishment system diverts resources from, you know, doing good things to doing things that are not in the best interest in, for many family members, for them all. And then, you know, again, another problem that comes up is often, not always, but often two families that are affected. The person who is going to be tried for capital punishment is definitely going to be in a place where they feel really helpless as well. And when we talk about capital trial, it really divides and puts two families against each other in a lot of ways, and it's really unfortunate when what we'd really like to see is less harm come, right? And most families that are going through this don't want to see another family also have to suffer through this process. And so that's one way that it divides families against each other. Mm-hmm. And I think this one, you know, how it delays justice is probably one of the ones that folks may be able to understand most, even if you're not a family member, but it just takes much, much longer in order to try a capital punishment case than it does a case you're seeking life without the possibility of parole or other possible sanctions or punishments. And so when you think about something that is, for most folks, the most tragic experience of their life. You want it to sound, want, you know, closure sooner rather than later, and capital punishment delays that. It's going to make it take much, much longer. You're going to have to go through many different iterations of court proceedings and appeals, and, you know, it's really unfortunate that the family members will have to go through all of that for so long. And so we'd like to see it replaced with something that can be a little bit more effective in administering justice and not be so riddled with problems and inconsistencies and flat out, you know, folks that are exonerated many years later that we have to put them through such a long process. Mm-hmm. It's just simply not a workable process, and we think if we got rid of it, everyone would definitely benefit from that. And so those are just some of the different ways that communities are damaged by the death penalty. And that we unfortunately can go on and on about that, but it's definitely something that has been shown over and over again that it's just a broken and flawed system that is not workable.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I just think about, I mean, I feel like any angle you come at it from, you'll find something pretty quickly. And I was thinking about the delay aspect of it, and pretty familiar with a couple cases, you know, that have stretched on for a couple decades. And just thinking of the bureaucracy involved with that and how many people would have retired, moved, quit during those 20 years, new people seeing it. That's probably, in many cases, how exonerations happen is by fresh eyes being on a case. People who don't have an ego attachment to having these capital cases, you know, whether it be prosecutors or other individuals. But yeah, what a nightmare. I mean, and just to be waiting for that long as well does not seem like a human way to treat one another. So, yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, the thing that sometimes folks forget is often, you know, it's the prosecutor's choice to go for capital punishment. And he or she is making that choice based on what they would like to achieve in their office in their particular situation and not on how it's going to affect the family members. And so when folks make that choice, you know, they are choosing to put the family through quite an ordeal pretty unnecessarily. And so, you know, it's something that we really feel is something that needs to be said, that capital punishment does not have to happen. It's not something that is mandated. It is something that folks in positions of power are making the choice to do it. And so when we think about the costs associated with the death penalty, I just think it's not exactly on the front of the prosecutor's mind as much as it should be. What will the cost be to the victim's family if we go through with this process? And so now we have folks that are going through with it in cases where it's not exactly the most open shot, and then 30 years later finding out that it is all wrong. And I, you know, I shudder to think about the families that have to go through the situation of thinking they may have found closure, and then 20, 30 years later having that wound reopened again. And it's something that is unnecessary. And, you know, it's something that our members think that's the main priority when we think about capital punishment is how is it affecting the family members involved. And it's just simply not right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the division also that you talked about, the other thing that I wanted to mention, I think I'm mostly thinking of Into the Abyss, which is a really intense Werner Herzog documentary about death row and capital punishment. Mm-hmm. And it goes deeply into the family's experience. And I think that with our kind of simplistic, fear-driven media that we have a lot of the time, that division becomes really aggressive and really intentional. Mm-hmm. And you see that, you know, the perpetrator or the, you know, supposed, the person who has committed the crime, their family will be portrayed as this bad family of bad people who do bad things and should be shamed. And particularly, I think these are the cases that get amplified. You know, if there's a photogenic, a victim who whose family can be characterized as all-American or as, you know, what have you, you know, something people can relate to, it drives the fear aspect of the story. But it also, I mean, oh, just to think of all the other things that can reinforce when we could be focusing on our commonalities and what went wrong for this person and how could prevention be part of this, you know, how could we change our culture and, you know, provide for people better so that these kind of things happen a lot less frequently. So, yeah. Thanks for organizing this.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's definitely something, you know, that we see, you know, for example, when the case is a situation where there's a black man, a white female, it's much more likely that they will see capital punishment. And so, you know, the sort of portrayal of certain communities against other communities is, you know, a really unfortunate situation with our justice system. But, you know, it's a truism when it comes to our justice system in general that it definitely has some very, you know, racist problems going on within it of how justice is applied, right? We don't see as much fervor in certain cases as in others. And so the capital punishment itself is, you know, part of the greater justice system that has been failing our lower income communities left and right. And as you can see, many different types of justice issues, but this one in particular, the ability to have strong legal counsel can make or break whether or not you're going to face capital punishment at all. And so we're seeing communities that can afford high-priced lawyers that can get out of the situation from the beginning may not face the same situation that someone that simply cannot afford a lawyer or is, you know, in a situation where they'll need a public defender that is overworked. And so it's not just about, you know, at the time where the person is convicted, you know, when the sentencing happens, that that's where the problem within the system happens. It's way at the beginning when we have folks that are forced into really high-pressure situations. When there's a murder happen, there's going to be law enforcement pressure to find who did it. And sometimes folks will be so pressured to find who did it that they end up trying to find someone to say that they did it. And that is a really unfortunate case, but we've seen many situations where low-income folks or folks that don't have the strongest understanding of the legal process are manipulated in the system and are forced to confess the crimes that they didn't actually commit. And then we have a perversion of justice that is not only going to affect the person that is going to be sentenced to this crime that they didn't commit, but everyone in the process that thought they got the guy, right? And this leaves real murderers and real folks that have actually committed crimes on the streets because they're looking to find and punish someone now instead of finding the right person that did it.
Yeah. Well, do you think that, and has it happened in other states that have already done this, do you think that abolishing, repealing, rather, the death penalty can kind of set off a positive chain reaction within the rest of the system? You know, if you get rid of the hammer, I don't know, do you think that it opens a door for other broader reform?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, we've seen many right off the bat, you know, different states that have passed, you know, a repeal of the death penalty that end up commuting a lot of the folks on death row. And so Maryland, for instance, is one of those situations recently where they commuted the folks on death row to life without possibility of parole. And so they were able to, at the very least, you know, put some finality for those folks that they will live out the rest of their time. And for, you know, the taxpayer, they're going to be saving a lot of money. And so I think nowhere has there been repeal where we've seen a situation where folks, you know, afterwards were now thinking they definitely want the death penalty back, right? Like that usually does not happen. Once it is repealed, it tends to be repealed for good because it's just smarter policy. And we think that it's something that will work for all communities. There are other and better ways to achieve justice than capital punishment. And so it's really ending the process of a flawed system rather than coming up with a solution of what to do afterwards. But, you know, we would like to see states that do that, do divert some of those resources to other things, victims, family members, other initiatives to help fight crime in communities. But at this point in time, you know, we haven't seen how the state has really shifted to a real positive level, but that's definitely something we work towards.
Great. Yeah, I guess, and those will probably be longer-term changes that may be hard to predict. This is a pretty current movement in the U.S. There's some states that abolished long ago, but I think there's a big upswell just in the 2000s and 2010s so far that hopefully Washington can, you know, throw some weight on and continue that trend. I think it's, let's see, is it 19 states without, 30-some states with? I had it pulled up and I closed the tab. Who have the death penalty?
Yeah, it's about that. There's a few more states that we like to include because they're de facto not using the death penalty, so they have it on the books still, but they don't actually use it. And so when there's a few different also moratoriums going on, and so then it changes so rapidly, it's hard to keep up sometimes, which is a good thing. But we're right about 25 or 26 states have either out and out repealed or not using it at all, or there's a form of moratorium. So we're right at about the 50-50 point.
Cool. That's a good point to be at. Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. We're on the right side of the arc of justice, so to speak.
Yeah. So obviously, Pat McCoy is sharing his story this week on Thursday. Does Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation have a collection or a set of stories that people can read if they're curious about this and about people's processing and journey with this?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the best things that we do, and we actually say, with MVFR that we're doing our best work when we're listening to stories of our members and sharing them with people that they would help benefit or might inspire them to advocate for what they believe in. And so we actually put out a Voices publication, and you can go to MVFR.org. You can look under publications and you can find MVFR Voices, and you'll see there that there's voices from all across the country. And luckily, Washington State is not up there yet, but we are producing a Voices booklet for Washington State that will be available, sadly, not when we're in Spokane, but when we are, when we're going to be joining the folks in Olympia when they have their lobby day on their 10th. So folks are definitely encouraged to join us on the 10th for lobby day. And so we'll have a booklet of all various Washington voices for folks to be able to read. And that should be up on our website here soon enough. We're still finalizing all the details on the text and the copy. And so in the next week or so, you'll be able to find it on our website. But go to MVFR, look up our publications, and you'll see there's folks from Colorado and Connecticut and California and Arkansas and all across the country from various backgrounds, shapes, and sizes.
Great. And I will share that here on the notes of the podcast when I publish that this weekend. And that is a great point that I did not bring up Lobby Day yet. I'm not sure how slots are being organized for that, but as you said, it's February 10th in Olympia. Is it a death penalty specific lobby day?
Yes, I believe so. I'm not personally in charge of the day, but if you go to the SJA website, they have the signups through February 2nd or 3rd. So you have to sign up soon, but the sign up is definitely more so to make sure we can meet with legislators that are in your district. And so if folks can't sign up, then they're still encouraged to come and join us and see what the process is like. But if you can sign up, it would be great, and we can contact your legislator and see if we can have a meeting with them while you're there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just so people know, that's Safe and Just Alternatives Washington partner, I'm assuming, right? Probably a frequent partner
yeah.
of you all. Who is doing that? So February
absolutely,
10th.
They're fantastic people. We're very happy to help and very happy to be there on their lobby day. Hopefully, we'll be sharing those voices booklets with all the legislators in the state. So I'm hoping to be able to drop a couple hundred of the voices of MVFR's finest Washington members and see how legislators respond.
That's great. I just think the more those stories can get out. You said it earlier that having people listen to stories is key, and that's really central to so many things. I mean, talking with so many of these issues overlap, talking to veterans, Veterans for Peace, who work on PTSD issues and dealing with their own trauma of having killed people and participated in violence. People who are recovering from all different sorts of trauma, obviously including murder victims. And I just think the more we get these conversations out in the open, the quicker we can come up with some great solutions and better ways of dealing with one another. So good work.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this goes back to your point about, moving towards a positive place. And sometimes the first step is to stop doing harm, right? Like we have to stop bringing more and more violence into our communities so that we can sit down for a minute without tragedy striking and talk about how to move forward. But as long as we're continuously going with violence and punitive punishments, the process of talking about what is the nonviolent solution to this problem can't even happen. Right. And I think that's things that, folks like the Veterans for Peace, who are another fantastic organization, know, right? They're folks that have seen violence firsthand and said, this is not a good idea. This is very much making the problem worse. And so I think that's, a lot of our members, share that with what the Veterans for Peace folks would say is that, this is definitely not helping us, and this is definitely making the situation worse. And so the first step for a lot of us is just to stop doing harm. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that's the step the state can take the best, right? It's to simply stop doing something that is simply not working and then let the local communities figure out how to move forward from there.
Yeah, that's a really good rule of thumb across the board, but especially in a case like this. And mm-hmm. for people just joining us at the end of the hour here, I'm talking with Jason Ortiz of Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation about this upcoming talk. Pat McCoy will be talking about his experience as a family member of a murder victim here in Spokane, his journey for reconciliation, his commitment to nonviolence, I'm assuming, based on everything you told me about him, and his ideas about abolishing the death penalty. That is going to be doors at 6:30 p.m., talk at 7 p.m., Thursday, February 5th at the Unitarian Universalist Church. I will post that event on the Praxis page on Facebook, facebook.com/Praxis Radio. You can also find it on the calendar at peacejustice.org. And those are two locations I know for sure. Jason, is there anything else you want to add just in the last 2 or 3 minutes that we have for folks who are listening?
Sure. I think the one thing that I want to just, you know, let folks know is that MVFR is definitely a community for family members. But the event and MVFR in general is not for just family members. We definitely invite anyone that has any opinions on the death penalty, whether for or against, to join us in Spokane and hear what Pat has to say. And then also, we invite anyone who's not a family member but maybe would just like to support MVFR. You can join us as a supporter. That's kind of how I started. We still need as many other activists and lawyers and friends and moms and families to help us out as possible and to be able to support the families that are really, you know, taking a real courageous step to talk about something that was really difficult for them for the betterment of society. And so there's always something that anybody that would like to get involved can do. And feel free to contact me directly, contact us through our website. But first, make sure you spread the word. If there's someone who maybe has lost a loved one to murder recently or to violence, you know, this is a great event for them to come and find some community.
That sounds great. And can you share your contact one more time for listeners
sure.
if they're curious about more?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Our website is mvfr.org. And so, you know, Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation is MVFR. And so our website is mvfr.org. And you can contact me directly either about the event or in general at jortiz@mvfr.org. That's my first initial and my last name. And I am the campaign strategist, so I deal a little bit more with campaigns and figuring out how to move policy forward. But we do have Marcel, who is our membership coordinator, who would love to talk to any family members that would like to get in contact with us.
Great. And obviously, to listeners, your most direct opportunity for that will be this Thursday, February 5th, where a lot of those organizers locally from this side of the state who are working to abolish the death penalty will all be there, I'm sure. So lots happening. And as you said, it's refreshing to be on in a campaign that's winning and tipping the
yeah.
scale.
And the other thing is that Washington is in a really good spot right now. So if there's anyone out there that was thinking about whether they should get involved, now is definitely the time.
Yeah. Great. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining me today with an improvised phone setup that seems to have worked great. And I will be sure to keep in touch with what you all are working on and share those links that I promised in the podcast later today.
All right. Thank you so much. Much appreciated. And I'll see you all soon.
All right. Thanks, Jason.
Take care.
So that was Jason Ortiz with Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. We will be, but they will be hosting an event Thursday, February 5th, as I said. And I just like to close the show with a short remembrance of a former guest here, a friend of mine and a great local organizer. His memorial is actually happening at this moment. Dwayne Cooper was the shop steward of AFSCME, he was a union organizer, I'm a little tongue-tied, working with Washington's young emerging labor leaders. I interviewed him and Graham Brown last year, and I'll be putting that interview back online as kind of a nod to him. Dwayne was just a really warm-hearted, fierce activist guy, and I'm so honored that I got to meet him when I did. He introduced me to some cool ideas and some good good energy. So rest in power, Dwayne. Thanks for joining me on the show when you did. To all listeners out there, you can find that rebroadcast show and today's show at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. That is linked on kyrs.org, our brand new website. You can also contact me there with any questions. But I just wanted to send you out with, I think this is being played at the memorial too today for Dwayne. This is his favorite speech, and it quickly became one of mine when he shared it with me when he was on the show last year. So rest in power, buddy, and all of you out there in Radio Land, have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks for listening. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!